I'm J.G. Michael, and this is Parallax Views.
Parallax is you observe an object, you see a change, but that change is not really a change in the object, but just a change in how you relate to the object in your perspective of the object.
Welcome to the testing room of the Parallax Corporation's Division of Human Engineering.
Now please cross the chair. And you will sit down. Make yourself comfortable. And be sure to place each one of your hands on the box on either side of the chair. Making sure that each one of your fingers is on one of the white rectangles. Just sit back. Nothing is required of you except to observe the materials that are presented to you. Be sure to keep your fingers on the box at all times. Alright? Hope you find the test a pleasant experience.
On this edition of Parallax Views, in these politically tumultuous times, some people are just looking for the exit sign. Our guest on this edition of the program is doing just that. Dr. Rob Williams is a media communications professor at Champlain College and the University of Vermont. He's also a musician, an enthusiastic yak farmer, and a supporter of the Second Vermont Republic, a movement that would like to see Vermont return to its status as an independent republic. In other words, seceding from the United States. I know, way out there, right? But the Second Vermont Republic isn't the only secessionist movement in the U.S. There are, of course, perhaps most notably, the odiously racist neo-Confederate movements still existing in the southern states, as well as the more recently well-known Cal Exit movement, which, as their name would suggest, want to see California exit from the Union. Fringe as it may be, I was interested in picking the brain of and getting inside the mind of someone who supports a secessionist movement in the United States. And as such, I reached out to Dr. Williams. In addition to discussing the Second Vermont Republic, we also chat about Dr. Williams' new book, The Post-Truth World, Fighting Fake News, with a 21st Century Propaganda Model for Our Digital Age. A short pamphlet of sorts, dealing with today's most pressing issues related to media in the digital age of the 21st century. And I hope that what we got out of speaking on both these topics was a rather interesting conversation for you, the listener, to hear. And with that being said, why don't we dive right into the conversation with Dr. Rob Williams, supporter of the Second Vermont Republic and author of The Post-Truth World. Welcome to Parallax Views, Dr. Rob Williams, author of The Post-Truth World, Fighting Fake News with a 21st Century Propaganda Model for our digital age, also a yak farmer and enthusiast, publisher of the Vermont Independent, man of many hats, I should just say, in conclusion.
JG, it's great to be here with you, talking to you from the Mad River Valley in Vermont. And yes, we Vermonters like to wear many hats. I'm just following the lead of my neighbors.
I forgot to mention musician as well, I believe.
Correct. Yeah, I play in a folk funk duo called the Phineas Gage Project.
I like that.
Yeah. Do you know the story of Phineas?
No, maybe you could tell me a little bit more.
Yeah, he was a 19th century railroad engineer, and he was building a railroad up the east side of Lake Champlain here in Vermont in 1848. September, he mistakenly and tragically blew a tamping iron through his brain, and it went through his skull and exited the other side, knocked him over, of course, and he ended up surviving and living for another 10 years. But tragically, his strong and steady engineering mind was completely rearranged by the tragedy. But his accident helped launch the study of modern brain science. And Phineas Gage is a legendary case study in all brain and neuroscience and psychology books. And when we play music, people are like, music makes our brain so happy. Your harmonies are so beautiful. So we decided to call ourselves Music for Happy Brains, the Phineas Gage Project. So that's the story of Phineas Gage.
Well, you know, that's a good tie-in. It sounds like you're a very proud citizen of Vermont. You published the Vermont Independent. Maybe you could talk a little bit about Vermont and how it has maybe informed your sort of worldview.
Yeah, sure. So I like to say I'm the worst kind of Vermonter. I'm from New York, although originally born in Pittsburgh, where I believe you are at the moment. The Yorkers and the settlers of the Hampshire Grants, as they were called back in the 18th century, had a long-running feud, and Ethan Allen and his merry band of Green Mountain Boys, essentially, to nutshell it for you and your listeners, Ethan Allen and the Green Mountain Boys held off the wealthy Yorkers, including Alexander Hamilton, and carved out of the Hampshire Grants the independent Republic of Vermont, homestead by homestead and town by town, in 18th century, and actually created Vermont as an independent republic, founded with their first constitution in 1777. And Vermont was actually its own republic for 14 years. It coined its own money, it fielded its own militia, it created its own bank, chartered its own towns, convened its own legislature. And Vermont is the only state out of all 50 in the United States of Empire, as I like to call the U.S. currently, the only 150 states that self-constituted without being wrested away from another country like Mexico by force, as was the case with Texas and California during the Mexican-American War. So, Vermont is a really interesting laboratory, always has been, for political and social and economic ferment. We're into trying new things here in Vermont and taking the best of the best. And Vermonters are pretty resilient and hardy and independent-minded bunch. And we are, you know, people, the national media has Vermont pegged as a blue state, and I think probably the Bernie Sanders phenomenon has helped that. But really, Vermont is more of a communitarian, decentralist, live and let live sort of a place. And I live in a river valley surrounded by conservative farmers who drive pickup trucks and, you know, carry guns on the rack and would happily pull you out of a ditch if you needed their help at a moment's notice. And that's kind of the way Vermont rolls. So it's an interesting place. And I got really sort of deeply interested in the Vermont independence conversation. There's about 21% of us now in the state, according to the latest poll from the University of Vermont, that indicates support for a second Vermont Republic. The idea that we would peacefully secede, break away from the United States as an imperial project and reinvent Vermont as a second Vermont Republic for the 21st century. So The Vermont Commons was our original print news journal, founded in 2005, and now we're publishing online at vermontindependent.net. And we're really just exploring this question and looking at all kinds of aspects of independence, socioeconomic and political and financial. And we have drafted a platform called Plan V, V for Vermont. Plan B, which is sort of a 12-point platform for independence. And I do a lot of the writing for Vermont Independent. We have a number of independent bloggers and columnists from around the country who contribute. And I do a lot with fake news and real journalism and communications and media. That's kind of my area, one of my areas of interest. So, yeah, so vermontindependent.net's kind of a nice clearinghouse for Vermont independence, but certainly not the only one. There's other Vermonters and other parts of Vermont running parallel projects, and it's all very interesting.
Well, you know, I wanted to ask, so is this related to or maybe a continuation of the work of figures like Kirkpatrick Sill, author of Human Skill, or Thomas Naylor and the Middlebury Institute, which they all basically supported the idea of Vermont secession or Vermont independence. Is there any relation to that?
Yeah, that's correct. In fact, I was radicalized in November 2004 at the RadCon conference at the Middlebury Inn in Middlebury, which was convened by Kirkpatrick Sale and Thomas Naylor. The two of them pulled together about 50 people from around North America to consider the question of, you know, what do we do after the U.S. as an empire collapses, which, you know, history teaches us all empires collapse sooner or later. And there are a lot of indications that the United States as an imperial project is trundling towards collapse. So in 2004, I attended the RadCon conference as a disinterested journalist and videographer. And after 3 days in the room with these people, I left kind of radicalized. And I went on to co-found a few months later the Vermont Commons News Journal with Ian Baldwin and Rick Foley and Gary Flominoft and a number of the other Vermonters that I had met at that conference. So, yes, we are deeply connected and inspired by the work of Kirkpatrick Sale. As you mentioned, probably his most famous book is Human Scale. And he is still very involved in the Middlebury Institute. And Thomas Naylor, who, alas, passed away several years ago, but was a real kind of gadfly and lightning rod and catalyst in his own unique way for Vermont independence, for sure.
Now, since we're talking about Vermont independence and sort of the idea of Vermont seceding from the Union, I'm curious, what is the makeup of the Vermont independence movement? Is it the same as, I think when people hear the word secession, they think of like neo-Confederate groups and whatnot in the South. Is the Vermont secession movement or the Vermont independence movement a little bit different from that? What's the makeup of it like?
Yeah, sure. So for your listeners, they should know that there are secession movements across the United States that run across the political spectrum. And I would say that the Vermont independence movement is probably kind of more green, more progressive, with a slight perhaps anarchist slash communitarian tendencies, which of course is a bit of a paradox, but that's kind of the way Vermont rolls. We are in loose conversation with independence groups across the country. Secession, to be clear, is a perfectly constitutional and legal and legitimate option for all states to exercise. And indeed, the United States itself was founded on the principle of secession. I'm sure your listeners have read the Declaration of Independence, penned by John Adams and Ben Franklin, and of course, most famously, Thomas Jefferson, who in the Declaration of Independence, the very first action verb they used was the verb dissolve, as in the 13 colonies will dissolve their political bands, as they said, with the British Empire. So the United States was founded on secession. Secession is as American as apple pie. It's baked into our DNA. And you used an interesting Lincolnian word just a moment ago, the word union, to describe the United States, which was not used in U.S. political parlance until after the Civil War, when Abraham Lincoln made it so. For the first 70 years of the United States, before the so-called Civil War or the War Between the States or the War of Northern Aggression, as the Southerners like to call it, or the War to Preserve the Union, as Northerners like to call it, there's that Lincolnian word, most American political observers really saw the United States as a compact or a contract between individual states. And the compact theory, which was a theory coined by Thomas Jefferson and James Madison and others, really was the dominant sort of constitutional theory of the antebellum period in the United States. So it's an interesting, you know, we live in interesting times. You're right. So, our textbooks have sort of done a number on us. We tend to associate the word secession with states' rights and the South and slavery and thereby racism and neo-Confederate impulses. But the reality of secession is way more interesting and way more nuanced and way more complex than that. And of course, there are secession conversations going on around the world as well. You know, the Catalonian Republic in Spain, for example, is you know, has all but seceded. what for the Spanish government essentially prosecuting secessionist leaders and imprisoning them and fining them and holding them to account. Scotland is looking to secede from England, interestingly, because Scotland wants to remain in the EU. And as you probably know from the election results a few days ago, it looks like Brexit will proceed, perhaps on an even more aggressive timetable than before under Mr. Boris Johnson. So it's all there's the secessionist impulse, I think, is an understandable decentralist reaction to the centralizing forces at work. Not just in the United States, but I think around the world.
Well, it's interesting, too. I've heard a lot more talk of secession after the 2016 election. I mean, there was talk of a California secession movement. I think the Trump phenomenon has really kickstarted a revived interest in this subject for some people.
Yeah, that's right. You know, the so-called Trump bump after 2016 was very good for business here in the 2VR, in the Second Vermont Republic. You know, much of the vocal part of Vermont is, you know, pretty progressive, pretty so-called liberal. So that is true. I like to joke that, you know, we got our start during the Bush-Cheney regime. And then Mr. Obama was elected in 2008, and the liberals and the progressives went to sleep for 8 years. Well, you know, Obama, you know, disallowed prosecution of the banks and blew up two wars to seven wars, and you know, ran a pretty moderate Republican presidency, and no one seemed to notice or care. And then when Mr. Trump was elected, of course, all hell broke loose on the left end of things. But you mentioned CalExit, the California secession movement, is a direct response to the Trump election. But that's not our gig here in Vermont. We take a bipartisan kind of critical perspective on empire. We recognize that the United States ruling elite is a bipartisan affair. It's the liberal Democrats and the more conservative Republicans who, at the end of the day, really seem to drive more or less the same bus, perhaps with different temperaments, but policy-wise, the endless wars continue, and the Constitution and the Bill of Rights continues to be shredded, and the banks continue to get bigger, and Wall Street continues to weigh more heavily on ordinary citizens. And I could go on, but so really we at the Second Vermont Republic take a fairly agnostic view on you know, Republicans versus Democrats, unlike many other secession movements across the country.
Why do you think there is a contingent in Vermont that is so supportive of Vermont independence? And what would the upsides to breaking away from the empire be?
Yeah, I think Vermonters have always been a pretty resilient bunch. And we kind of like to go our own way here in Vermont. And we don't like to be told what to do. And that sort of goes all the way back to Ethan Allen, really even before that. And Vermont has a proud history of standing up to entrenched centralized power, as I mentioned earlier. So I think, again, that's kind of built into the DNA of Vermont. And have you had occasion to visit the Green Mountains?
I have not. I've heard it's beautiful there, though.
It is beautiful. And it's also, you know, hard scrabble living. You know, I was just before I jumped on the call with you, I was out, you know, moving winter firewood around, and it's snowing right now, and it's going to be bitterly cold tomorrow. And, you know, it's cold and dark in Vermont for half the year. And Vermonters really kind of eked out, clawed out, you know, town by town, a pretty interesting network of communities here over the past few hundred years. And certainly life is much easier now in the age of fossil fuel energy and interstate highways and the internet. But I think that impulse towards contrarianness and independence and self-sufficiency and resilience is very much alive. So I think that accounts for kind of this interest in independence. I also think Vermonters tend to be pretty fair and compassionate and humane at the end of the day. We do have this live and let live tolerance here in Vermont. And it's certainly not perfect, but our little polity here, but I think that impulse is very much alive and well. And so I think when Vermonters look out at the United States and see the kind of the entrenched economic and political elites kind of wreaking their havoc on the world, I think there's a lot of frustration and interest in addressing that. And decentralism is one powerful option for doing that. In terms of upsides,
Before you go on to the upsides, I just wanted to ask real quick. I guess that decentralism is often viewed as a more conservative or sort of libertarian sort of tendency, but I think you've made a case that it can also be applied to a sort of left-wing worldview.
Yeah, I mean, again, I think it's a little bit more complex than that. I think in some ways, you know, one could argue that kind of the biggest block in Vermont to Vermont independence are kind of the big state liberals who kind of have a knee-jerk support for everything that is big, whether it's, you know, big banks or big government or the notion that government will solve all of our problems, that sort of thing.
I see what you mean,
yeah. Yeah, and I'm certainly not I'm a believer in government appropriately scaled, and I just retired from 15 years of life on our school board, and my wife was head of the select board here in our town for many years, and so we're certainly not allergic to the civic process and small d democratic debate and discussion. In fact, I think that's at the end of the day what's going to save us. And Vermont has a long tradition of town meeting every first Tuesday in March, where citizens in every town get together and talk and debate and discuss how to spend our tax money for the next year and how we're going to allocate our resources, and sitting down for a chicken pot pie lunch and making sure everybody's keeping the train on the tracks in most of the towns across the state. And we still vote with what's called a pen and a paper ballot in much of Vermont. And we still count our votes on paper ballots by duly elected, transparently sourced boards of civil authority and gymnasiums across the state after every election. And, you know, we like transparency and accountability, and we're not super happy, a lot of us, with those trends running the opposite direction across the United States.
So maybe we should look at it more as less left or right wing and more cooperative and sort of a communalist take on things.
Yeah, that's absolutely right. The way I think about framing it really is, if you're going to have a dualistic frame, which is always problematic, it's really kind of, I think, corporations versus the commons, if you will. The commons being sort of our shared public resources, our incredibly beautiful green mountain landscapes, our rivers, our mountains, the fresh air that we are enjoying here, the clean water for the most part that we're enjoying here, our public schools, which are always ranked near the top in the United States. We invest heavily in our public schools, our libraries, our roads, our volunteer fire departments, and I could go on. But yeah, there's a really rich tradition of public spirited and public commonwealth here in Vermont. And our state motto perhaps captures it best, which our state motto is freedom and unity, which I think really speaks to this kind of desire for independence, but also our reciprocal social bonds to one another in our small communities.
Well, I want to move on to your pamphlet, The Post-Truth World. But I do want to ask, I want to go back to those upsides and maybe get your take, if I can play devil's advocate here for a second.
Sure.
There are people that are going to listen to this and say, oh, secession, that was decided by the Civil War. It can't happen. That's crazy. And why would anyone want to do that in the first place? How would you respond to that?
Well, I think secession, as I said earlier, is, you know, baked into the American DNA. I mean, it really does go back to the United States' founding documents, and I think that's pretty clear. And most everyone in the United States agreed for the first 70 years of the U.S. history as a republic that constitutionally secession was a viable option for individual states or groups of states to exercise if they so choose. Granted, it's a fairly dramatic option, but an option nonetheless. So, as I said earlier, I think the so-called Civil War kind of did a number on us. You know, we kind of secession got tainted with the brush of racism and slavery. But it really was, to remind your listeners as well, it was the New England states long before the Southern states who first proposed the idea of constitutional secession during the War of 1812 at the Hartford Convention in Connecticut in 1814, when they looked at perhaps breaking away from the United States early on. So that conversation about secession has been alive and well at various times in various places across the United States. And it's certainly very much alive and well in the 21st century United States, albeit for a host of different reasons held by different groups across the political spectrum. But I think that kind of discussion and debate is healthy. I mean, that's really what makes a small d democracy a democracy at the end of the day, that you explore different choices and options. And if there is enough political will to make peaceable secession happen, it will happen. I don't think any court or any branch of any government is going to stop it. If there's enough interest, it will happen. And certainly people say, well, what would the United States do if Vermont chose to absent itself from the United States? That's anybody's guess. But we here in Vermont have to do what we believe is best for our own citizens and our own communities. And it may be that moving into the 21st century, that peaceable secession is the most viable.
You got cut off. You said it may be the most viable solution.
Oh, okay. Great. So I can pick it up from there.
Yeah.
Great. Yeah. So, well, that's a good ending place, actually.
Okay. And I guess before we move on, any upsides that you could give in favor of this Vermont independence movement?
Yeah, sure. Well, I think the upsides would include Vermonters getting to determine how to engage with the rest of the world on our own terms, rather than terms dictated to us by Wall Street or the U.S. military industrial complex or the national security state. I think you could argue we'd certainly pay a lot less in taxes, since, you know, more than 50 cents of every tax dollar seems to go to be destroying other parts of the world to advance U.S. full spectrum dominance and global hegemony around the world. So let's start there. I think if you look around the world, there are many, many nations and states with populations smaller than Vermont and geographical areas smaller than Vermont who are doing just fine. And we list many of those on our website, vermontindependent.net, in our FAQ, our frequently asked questions section of that website at vermontindependent.net. So I'd encourage your listeners to pay us a visit there and read up on Vermont independence for themselves. And again, you know, the 21st century is a bit of a moving target. It's a little unclear what lies ahead, but certainly we have some pretty big planetary dilemmas that we're all wrestling with, all 8 billion plus of us on the planet. And I wake up every morning intensely interested in where we're going to go. So,
well, you know, I think to segue into your pamphlet, The Post-Truth World, which I got turned on to it by Project Censored, Mickey Huff, who is a great friend of the show. And
oh, good.
I found it interesting. You start out the pamphlet with a quote from Mark Twain, and a lot of people just think of Mark Twain as the guy who wrote The Adventures of Tom Sawyer and The Adventures of Huckleberry Finn, but he was so much more than that.
Yes, agreed. Mark Twain was one of perhaps the greatest literary Americans who has ever been with us. He was a world traveler. He was a essayist and a novelist and a nonfiction writer, and he was also an anti-imperialist, which many people don't know. He was very critical of the United States as an imperial project 100 years ago. Very outspoken against U.S. How shall we say, indiscretions abroad. So I'm a big fan of Mark Twain, and he's been a real literary and philosophical inspiration for me.
I like the quote that you used from him too. If you don't read the newspaper, you're uninformed. If you read the newspaper, you're misinformed. You're a media educator. Why did you sort of choose that quote, and what is your view of media in America today?
Well, I'm a big media hound, and I teach communications and journalism and media and social media for a living at the University of Vermont and Champlain College and elsewhere in Burlington. I run a newspaper, as you know. I'm very active on social media. I like to joke. I have six Instagram accounts, all for different projects. And I think communication is something that we sapiens have been doing for, you know, God knows, tens of thousands of years, you know, around the campfire and now around the electronic campfire. So I tend to take sort of a both and approach, to 21st century media. There's a lot of sort of tendencies in our bifurcated, you know, kind of binary, dualistic age to say, well, you know, media is all bad or media is all good. And I don't really find that helpful as a frame. That being said, I chose the Twain quote because I think of much of what passes for news in our 21st century news industry. And it is an industry. It is a for-profit corporate commercial enterprise for the most part. I think much of what passes for news in the 21st century is just one-sided propaganda. And it doesn't matter what side of the political spectrum you fancy yourself to be on. I think what we are consuming as news tends to be something else. It could be misinformation. It could be disinformation. It could be propaganda. But I always teach my students in my news classes the definition of real news. And to me, real news has six elements. It's number one, it's recent. Number two, it's relevant. Number three, it's reliable, which is to say it's transparently sourced. And when I say news, I'm talking about storied information here. You know, information that is encoded in stories, which is something we sapiens have done for millennia. So recent, relevant, reliable, storied information. Number four, it's historically contextualized. I think so much of what passes for news is kind of a one-off, what the great writer Wallace Degner called the amputated present. Like we live in the amputated present, you know, tweet by tweet and gram by gram. Number five, it's hegemonically hip, which is to say real news foregrounds power relations, which is something you don't often see, I think, even in the pages of august journals like the New York Times or the Washington Post or the Wall Street Journal. And then finally, real news is, as my Chinese friends like to say, harmonious, which is to say it has multiple points of view. It's multi-perspectival. It's not this kind of he said, she said, black versus white, blue versus red, unnamed officials quoted as saying kind of stuff. So that's real news: recent, relevant, reliable, historical, hegemonic, and harmonious. And if you hold up that six ingredient elixir to any news story passing through the pipes right now, you'll find that there's really not that much news out there at all. A lot of it is propaganda. And I have a short list of journalists I really feel are doing a bang up job on, particularly on political news. I think, you know, it's easy to read the New York Times and get the weather or the sports or the latest in arts and movies and entertainment and TV and dance and all that's great. You know, that's news. That's important. But when it gets to sort of political news, you know, either domestically or in terms of foreign policy, I think that's where we see a lot of propaganda at work. And so I spent a lot of my time with my students and in my own world, really thinking closely about what real news actually looks like and what these so-called news stories are actually up to when they pass themselves off as news.
I like that you start out the pamphlet with a sort of play on words. You put introduction, the post-truth world, and that's a reference to Steven Spielberg's The Post, last year's hit fictional film based on a true story focusing on the Washington Post's 1971 publishing of the Pentagon Papers. And I found it interesting that you honed in on that and took a critical view of it because everyone was gushing over that movie. And all I could think when I, you know, heard about it was, why is Daniel Ellsberg, the guy who leaked the papers and put his life on the line for it, why does he only get like 15 or 20 minutes? Why are we celebrating the technocratic establishment at the Washington Post and not Ellsberg? We need a movie about him.
Yeah. You know, it's funny about that, too. Just an interesting I don't know if you saw the new movie on Amazon, The Insider, with Adam Driver, who plays the Senate aide who breaks the torture story wide open. It takes him years to do it. But Matthew Rhys-Meyers does a cameo in that movie as a New York Times reporter. And of course, it's the same actor, Matthew Rhys-Meyers, who is the Ellsberg character in the Post movie. So I laughed out loud when when Rhys-Meyers appeared in this new movie. As like, I guess that's on his resume, is to play like the bit part of the important character whose story goes untold in these sorts of movies. But yeah, it was kind of funny.
Well, what is your criticism of Spielberg's telling of the story, and maybe how that ties into the issue of critical media literacy?
Yeah, well, you know, Steven Spielberg is a brilliant filmmaker, and he's very gifted behind the camera. The problem with The Post, I mean, you just kind of summarized it a bit, but it really kind of romanticizes and romanticizes this very important moment when the news establishment got religion and decided to run with a story that the courageous whistleblower Daniel Ellsberg delivered to them wheelbarrow by wheelbarrow over the course of many secret months of Xeroxing these Pentagon papers. And what's so interesting about the movie is nowhere does it really account for the years and years of the New York Times and the Washington Post, which at the time was owned by the Graham family. And Katharine Graham, played by Meryl Streep in the movie, is painted as this kind of proto-feminist and this courageous woman standing up to male power and the patriarchy. And, you know, that plays very well, of course, in this Me Too, post-Me Too moment that we're in. But what the movie missed entirely was the years and years of these establishment news journals doing the bidding of the national security state, promoting the U.S. invasion of Vietnam, unquestioningly accepting the Lyndon Johnson Tonkin Gulf resolution story, or the JFK we must build up advisors in Vietnam story, or, you know, go back a ways. And really what I highlight in the book, the Post-Truth World book, is the cozy relationship that these news editors and publishers enjoyed with members of the Central Intelligence Agency and with the so-called deep state, these unelected federal agencies that have, you know, very real skin in the game when it comes to U.S. foreign policy in particular. And that was really frustrating to watch, actually, on the silver screen.
Well, I mean, it's fascinating because that movie basically hangs all the blame on Nixon at the end.
Well, absolutely. That's it. Nixon takes the fall, you know, in the same way that, you know, Trump keeps taking the fall for you know, offending and daring to attack the other side of the elite aisle, you know, most currently with, you know, the Biden family and Ukrainegate, right? And, you know, Trump dared to call out the CIA and the FBI early on in his presidency, and he dared to suggest that perhaps the U.S. could thaw its relations with Putin's Russia and perhaps remove troops from the Middle East. And, you know, the national security state is absolutely opposed to all of that. And so to paint Trump as some kind of deranged lunatic, because particularly, I think, in his foreign policy, he is refusing to toe the line of the national security state. And who knows if he's doing it intentionally or if he's kind of stumbling his way through it. I have no idea. But you know, we've seen what happens to presidents in the past when they dare to do this. You know, Kennedy, John Kennedy, being the most famous example of that, perhaps. But so there's no sense that the U.S. news media bears any responsibility for essentially propagandizing for years through Democratic and Republican administrations, propagandizing to the American people on these incredibly important foreign policy decisions and issues like the Vietnam War, which killed, we're not even sure how many, you know, maybe 2 million, maybe more Vietnamese, which laid waste to the entire country of Vietnam, which turned the whole country of Vietnam, really Indochina as a whole, into a giant lab experiment for new chemical and biological and geoengineering weapons. Kill everything that moves was official Pentagon policy in Vietnam and Indochina. And most Americans have no idea that that was the case. Nick Turse, brilliant independent journalist, wrote a book called Kill Everything That Moves, based on some FOIA-requested Public Information Act released Pentagon documents a couple of years back. And it's an incredible, incredible book. And of course, you know, 57,000 plus U.S. soldiers lost their lives in Vietnam as well. And all of that was because the U.S. news media did not engage the establishment in raising critical questions about what was really going on in Vietnam. And that's what the Post, what Spielberg's movie completely overlooks, and it glosses over it. And the irony, of course, is that I'm sure your listeners, some of them know that the Graham family sold the Washington Post to Jeff Bezos and Amazon for $250 million a couple of years ago. And now you have Jeff Bezos, who owns Amazon. He's the world's richest man. He's some have described him as a predatory capitalist. Amazon is hoovering up every, you know, one out of every two retail dollars in the U.S. economy right now. It's crushing main streets coast to coast. Bezos enjoys hundreds of millions of dollars in cloud computing contracts with the CIA. He sits on boards at the Pentagon, and he runs Washington, D.C.'s daily newspaper of record with the Washington Post. And the greatest irony, of course, is that the slogan at the Post is democracy dies in darkness. And I think what we're looking at right
even
now,
even though everything's paywalled, it dies in darkness.
Yeah,
they paywall
it, dies behind the paywall in darkness, perhaps. Yeah. Yeah. So it's, you know, it's a really, to me, the Post was like the perfect metaphor. When you took Spielberg's movie and you combined it with this phrase, the post-truth, which was the Oxford English Dictionary's phrase of the year in 2016. And our mutual friend and colleague, Mickey Huff, and I, you know, we talk and joke and cry quite a bit about that. Of course, we don't live in a post-truth world, right? The truth is out there, but gleaning the truth is a very challenging task in this politically polarized age when so much of what passes for news is, in fact, propaganda.
Well, I was going to add to that, you know, it's a difficult discussion apparently for a lot of people to have, but a lot of journalists that are very respected have in a way become just cogs in the establishment. I mean, I think of Bob Woodward, who everyone knows for Watergate.
Yeah.
But Christopher Hitchens, when Hitchens was alive, he was correct, in my view, when he said Woodward has become a stenographer for the Beltway, essentially. But
yeah,
it seems like being critical of these things is now more frowned upon than it ever has been.
Well, I think that's right. I think if you want to be a career journalist, and let's remember that journalism, the news industry, is in deep trouble, right? And that story has been well told. But to be a career journalist and work at a newspaper of any repute or record really requires that you self-censor. Then you kind of toe the company line. Journalists learn pretty quickly what stories they can investigate and what stories they should stay away from. And the folks at Project Censored, projectcensored.org, I know you're familiar with their work, but Peter Phillips, the previous director, routinely surveyed journalists who said, I forget the exact percentage, but I think it's more than certainly the majority of journalists, when they're honest, admit to self-censoring, meaning they're not covering stories they know are important because they don't want to get in trouble, essentially. So they figure out which stories will play and which won't. So there's all kinds of challenges, legitimate challenges to journalism. How do we pay for it and how do we fund it? And how do we make sure that we're getting real news instead of propaganda? Certainly the internet, social media, monopoly share on monopoly social on Facebook and monopoly search in Google. These big tech companies have certainly, worked hard to and are working harder to marginalize independent voices.
I mean, Google search function has become useless at this point.
Well, absolutely. Yeah, they're really, they're gaming the algorithm, the proprietary codes by which we're served up news and information or not served up news and information. And this is what I get into in the propaganda model, where I take Noam Chomsky and Ed Herman's 30-year-old model from their book, Manufacturing Consent, published back in 1988, and really try and reinvigorate the propaganda model that they pioneered for our digital age. So what I did with that is I added five new filters to their five filters in the model. And for those unfamiliar with the propaganda model, Chomsky and Herman basically posit there are five powerful filters through which all raw information has to pass before it's blessed and sanctified as legitimate, quote unquote, news.
And none of this is done conspiratorially from the view of Chomsky and Herman.
Yeah, that's right. This is a guided market system, as they call it, and this all happens through relationships between journalists, editors, publishers, and the filters in question. Number one, advertisers who pay the piper and call the tune. Number two, owners like Bezos's Amazon or Bezos owning Amazon and connected to the Pentagon and the CIA and running the Washington Post. I mean, it doesn't take a genius to figure out, what stories are going to play and what aren't there. Newsmakers, news shapers, those celebrities, sports figures, pop stars, politicians who are newsmakers by virtue of being high profile and kind of in play in the culture. News shapers are PR firms and think tanks and foundations that create white papers and policy briefings and then massage them into the news cycle to pass them off as legitimate news. And then finally, what Chomsky and Herman called flack or negative criticism. If you are a journalist or a newspaper who gets a little uppity or begins to sort of go down a road the guided market system is not happy with you going down, you will hear about it. And the extreme punishment for anyone who does that in this digital day and age is so-called deplatforming, right? You have your accounts, your social media accounts suspended for practicing journalism outside the boundaries of the acceptable guidelines of the guided market system. So it's a really interesting time. And I added five filters: algorithms, filter bubbles, behavioral micro-targeting, sock puppets, and deep state disinformation, which I mentioned earlier, Operation Mockingbird, with the Vietnam War connection. Those five filters I added for the digital age to the propaganda model, and I've been teaching those to my undergraduates in communications at the University of Vermont, and I know that Project Censored now has a hold of the new book, and they've been publishing the new propaganda model in their books and platforms. So we're really on both coasts trying to get the word out about this. And this is, I should say, JG, this is not a partisan effort on any of our part. This is a nonpartisan, apolitical approach, which I think makes it particularly important and resonant for our very strange, politically polarized times. to use this propaganda model to make sense of what is real news and what is not.
Well, before we close out here, because I know we're short on time, I do have to ask you, we live in a moment where I think there is a real problem of fake news. I think there are, you know, websites that peddle utter crud and pass it off as news. at the same time, Silicon Valley's solution to this problem is ultimately going to completely wipe out alternative and independent media. And that itself is something we should be concerned about.
Absolutely. Yeah, you're absolutely right. And increasingly, I'm feeling like it's partly why I'm publishing books back in print and as PDFs and trying to carve sort of a parallel path to the digital news services right now, because you're right. It's sort of like with our digital votes, our electronic votes through, you know, electronic ballots that are filtered through proprietary voting machine software that is easily hacked in minutes by 8-year-olds. So such is true of our digital news. It's very easy to algorithmically game or marginalize legitimate news stories of importance because they are in some way threatening to the status quo. And I think moving forward, my hope is we're going to see a lot more use of the propaganda model and a lot more independent news and journalism sites that are doing end runs around these gatekeepers, these digital gatekeepers at Google and Facebook. And, you know, we don't need Mark Zuckerberg or Eric Schmidt at the Googleplex or whoever's running Google now, I forget, to determine, you know, what's legitimate news and what isn't. I think as citizens with brains in our heads, we should be able to do this ourselves. And that's why critical media literacy, by the way, is so important and why it should be taught really kind of cradle to grave. Not in a partisan way, you know, not like either the Trumpsters or the neoliberals on the left, you know, that
well, but in a way that has in a way that entrusts we the people to be able to read news media critically, rather than treating the masses as dumb plebs and only the technocrats can figure things out. People are much smarter than we give them credit for.
Well, that's absolutely right. And I think the biggest problem actually, JG, is the way in which all of our major social and digital media platforms are algorithmically configured to bring polarization and divide us rather than the opposite. And this is such an important, this is a good place to end maybe, because it's such an important takeaway. When anyone goes onto YouTube and they search for a video of some political figure with a policy or an idea or an ideology, rather than YouTube saying, or any other social media platform saying, oh, I see you're watching Donald Trump on building a wall. Well, here are three other perspectives on the wall, which are all kind of diverse and complementary, or maybe they present you with different political points of view. And maybe as a discerning citizen, you should weigh those and determine how you feel about them. What we get is we get more extreme versions of Donald Trump or Bernie Sanders or Tulsi Gabbard or Hillary Clinton, or insert your favorite politician here. And that's true across the board, right? So we're algorithmically being programmed into tribes right now. And that is a huge, huge problem for democracy and debate and discourse and public conversation. And that's why critical media literacy really matters. And that's why independent news served up outside of these filter bubbles and these algorithms is really important. And that's why, as I said, I've been publishing, I've been bringing back the pamphlets like Thomas Paine during the American Revolution to bring it all home, because, you know, Paine was a great believer in ordinary people and citizens who are capable of discourse and debate. And we need to bring that back in the 21st century. So we're committed to that.
Well, I want to give you a chance to plug the Vermont Independent, tell my listeners how they can get a hold of the Post-Truth World book, and anything else you want to plug. I think We've already ended, I think, on a positive note, which is something I always like to do on the program, so I want to thank you for that. Anything you want to plug, though?
Sure. Well, why don't we give away to anyone who's listening who would like a free electronic copy of the new book, The Post-Truth World. All they need to do is email me at contact@drrobwilliams.com, and I'd be happy to send along a free e-copy, a free PDF of our brand new book. It's a great classroom resource. I've had a lot of interest about it from teachers, and a couple of professors are already using it in the classroom for next semester. And I think it really brings a nice, nonpartisan, critical, thoughtful, and fun approach to making sense of real news or fake news and real journalism in the digital age. So contact@drrobwilliams.com. Happy to give that away to your listeners. And it's been such a pleasure talking with you, JG, and I hope we can do it again soon.
I want to add real quick, you can print out those PDFs, folks, and spread them around the community as well.
Yes, please do that. Please do that. That'd be great.
Okay, thank you again, Dr. Rob Williams, for coming on Parallax Views.
JG, thanks for having me. I hope you have a fantastic holiday season, and let's talk again in 2020.
Well, that does it for this edition of Parallax Views. I hope you enjoyed my conversation with Dr. Rob Williams, supporter of the Second Vermont Republic and author of The Post-Truth World, Fighting Fake News with a 21st Century Propaganda Model for Our Digital Age. And of course, if you can, email Dr. Williams for a free PDF copy of that very book. It was a rather interesting pamphlet, and you can print it out, pass it around in your community. I think that would be just great. Let me know what you thought of this edition of Parallax Views by dropping me a line on Twitter at ViewsParallax, or by email at parallaxviewspod@protonmail.com. Also, please consider supporting me on Patreon. I'll be releasing two editions of Parallax Views the week that was, one with Marlon Ettinger, very special bonus episode, and another with my usual partner in crime for that current events program, Casey. So there's that to look forward to for my Parallax Views Patreon subscribers. And with that being said, until next time, you've been listening to Parallax Views with Parallax Views. To Parallax Views with Parallax Views.
The way out is not simply to say don't do it, just to prohibit. It's nothing else. If we don't do it, others will be doing it like crazy. So, you know, we have to confront the problem. But no, basically, I know of the great anxiety, problems, new forms of control, but it's also new forms of freedom. This is why I always emphasize that internet and all this new digital stuff, it's a very ambiguous phenomenon, but it's the field of struggle. New forms of enslavement, but at the same time, new incredible forms of freedom. We have to accept the fight. With no nostalgia for old, allegedly more authentic communities or whatever. I'm not afraid. I'm not afraid. I'm not afraid. I'm not afraid.